Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. Although the latest bombings in Boston don't appear to have overseas fingerprints, we'll begin with an analysis of the national security issues that arise out of this attack on Americans, possibly by other Americans. Heather Hurlburt, the Executive Director of the National Security Network, joins us to discuss how secure our homeland is. Then we will examine the failure of the Senate today to even consider a watered-down bill on expanding background checks on weapon sales and the president's angry response to what he called a shameful day in the nation's capital. Dennis Hennigan, the author of Lethal Logic, Exploding the Myths That Paralyze American Gun Policy, and John Donahoe, the author of Shooting Down the More Guns, Less Crime Hypothesis, join us to discuss how the gun lobby is able to thwart the will of 90% of Americans. Then finally, we'll examine the Vatican's war against American nuns for promoting radical feminist themes that the new Pope Francis, who has been warmly received by liberal Catholics, is continuing, reaffirming the hardline doctrinal crackdown by his predecessor. Kenneth Briggs, who writes for the National Catholic Reporter and is the author of Double Crossed, Uncovering the Catholic Church's Betrayal of American Nuns, joins us. Joining us now is Heather Hurlburt, who is Executive Director of the National Security Network, where her policy work focuses primarily on the politics of U.S. foreign policy, counterterrorism and resilience, and the nexus of civilian and military approaches to conflict resolution. She has previously served in the White House, State Department, and Congress, and from 1995 to 2001, she served in the Clinton administration as Special Assistant and Speechwriter to the President, Speechwriter for Secretaries of State Albright and Christopher, and a member of the State Department's policy planning staff. Welcome to Background Briefing, Heather Hurlburt.
Thanks, Ian. It's great to be with you.
And what's happening in Boston, and of course, we've been waiting since 5 p.m. Eastern today for a press conference that the FBI and other law enforcement officials were going to hold, where at least the rumors were that they were going to release some evidence of a suspect or even an arrest. But that's been delayed, and it still hasn't happened as of now. But the question that arises to my mind is it gets to the fundamental issue of what national security is. And, of course, throughout the Cold War, there was a rather narrow definition of national security, essentially about how many missiles the U.S. had and how many the Russians had, and largely a bean-counting kind of argument about our national security. But since the transnational and subnational threats have taken over, obviously it is a more murky landscape. But if Americans are killing other Americans with IEDs that we normally associate with the war on terror, what does that say about our own homeland security?
You know, it's really interesting that, in fact, the incidence of domestic terrorism and the fatalities caused by domestic terrorism were much higher in the United States in the 70s than they are now. And yet we didn't, you didn't see as much of the hand-wringing, say, about getting, we had a lot of, relatively speaking, hijackings in the 70s, and you didn't see the hand-wringing about getting on an airplane. So, you know, one of the things, frankly, that's happened is that our definition of security has become more personal. And as our media has become more personalized, we're much more able to be aware of and be obsessive about events that happen. It's also fascinating that, of course, there are many things much more dangerous than terrorism in American life, which we don't obsess about. I mean, now we're all going to worry about pressure cookers in a way that we don't worry about cars, for example. So, you know, the United States does face serious but manageable national security threats, you know, on the level of countries developing nuclear weapons or very real terrorist groups that do wish us ill. And then there's the sort of level of things that are frightening in our daily lives, but that don't, in fact, pose much of a threat to you, Ian, in Southern California, or me, Heather, at my house in Maryland. And our public discourse has really sort of confused the two.
Well, if indeed this is the area of asymmetrical warfare, then the IED seems to be the weapon of choice, does it not?
Well, again, this isn't entirely new. You know, if you remember that the very first World Trade Center bombing was an improvised explosive device in a car. Recipes for extremists, violent extremists of all kinds, to make homemade bombs have been around for a long time. If you knew where to look for them, now they're sort of easier to find on the internet, and we're all more aware of them because of their use in Iraq and Afghanistan. So, you know, it's much less that this is a phenomenon that we've never seen before than that it's a phenomenon that we're now all hyper aware of and that we're able to watch over and over again on TV or on YouTube.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Heather Hilbert, who's Executive Director of the National Security Network, where her policy work focuses primarily on the politics of U.S. foreign policy, counterterrorism and resilience, and the nexus of civilian and military approaches to conflict resolution. Of course, in the era that you mentioned, the 70s, with all the hijackings to Cuba and the anti-war activities, which involved some bombings, we, of course, didn't have this vast bureaucracy known as Homeland Security, which I, you know, believe soaks up about a trillion dollars, I think, since 9/11 has been spent. And that is, of course, in response to 9/11. And in terms of the arenas that you worked in particular with State Department's policy planning staff, I noticed the other day that John Kerry, the new Secretary of State, when he was in, I think, South Korea, mentioned that foreign students were leery of coming to the United States because of the threat of gun violence. And, of course, that has been, I think, reinforced by the death of one of the three people that were killed in this bombing in Boston was a Chinese exchange student. So, as one who has tried to worked in the business of putting America's best foot forward abroad, how important is it as an issue the way that others around the world see the security that we that they question in terms of our national security, you know, which means that they don't feel secure on our streets?
Yeah, I mean, to the first point you made, it is a very important thing for Americans to realize that our Homeland Security spending and our military spending more than doubled in the years after 9/11, and that we have definitely reached a point, and different people will disagree on when we reached this point, but we have certainly reached it where a marginal dollar spent does not buy you another dollar of security, and that's a very hard national conversation that we have to have. As far as sort of how what happens here and what we choose to do here, you know, it has an enormous effect on how we're viewed overseas. You know, and after 9/11, it was almost impossible for many foreign students from many places to get visas. And, you know, foreign students coming to the U.S., which is both a huge source of financial support for universities, a huge source of highly skilled immigration to the U.S., and a huge source of people who go back to their home countries with positive views of the U.S. and rise to senior positions in their own societies favorably disposed to us. You know, all of those things, we really gave ourselves a self-inflicted wound. And, you know, the irony of having this media, which is one of the freest, most open, and, you know, least inhibited for better and for worse in the world, is that yes, you see Chinese chat boards lighting up today with questions about, is it safe to study in the U.S.? Is it safe to study in Boston? You know, anytime something happens in the U.S., those questions arise anywhere that people follow American popular culture, even though, you know, in fact, terrorist attacks happen, terrorist attacks that affect Americans are less than 1% of the total number of terrorist attacks that happen around the world. You know, Boston was only the third or fourth deadliest bombing that happened in the world on Monday. So, you know, we're all mourning and we're all horrified by what we saw. We still have it incredibly good and incredibly safe in this country, But equally, because we have a media and a culture that can look at everything over and over again, we have this perception that we're not safe, and ironically, people in countries that may be less safe than here have that perception too.
So what about the issue, Heather Hilbert, of, I guess, for the want of a better description, of paranoia, in the sense that the militia movement seemed to emerge after the Cold War ended. Now, maybe it was there bubbling beneath the surface in various backwoods, but it really came to the fore after the end of the Cold War. And some analysts, and particularly around the time of the Oklahoma City bombing, made the suggestion that there's a kind of Manichaeanism here, that we had the Soviet enemy for so long that was a perfectly cast bad guy. And then with all of these paranoid theories about black helicopters and UN world government and people surreptitiously putting computer chips in your backside, etc., those scenarios seem to emerge, and it led some to believe that there is a kind of need for an enemy, a kind of quotient of paranoia that we as a culture have.
I would say first that there's a pretty basic, unfortunately, to human beings, temptation to look for enemies. And the greater the uncertainty that human beings find themselves in, and this goes back to your question of how do we define security and how do we think about security as a society, but the more insecure we as human beings feel at any level, the more we seem to look for enemies, to look for in-groups and out-groups. And so, you know, I don't think it's any accident that we became much more aware of extremist activity of all kinds after the Cold War ended. I don't think it's an accident that those incidents rise in periods of economic distress. And I also don't think it's an accident that, you know, frankly, I would look as much at globalization as I would at the end of the Cold War. And the ways that, you know, many of the certainties that people in the United States had about their lives or how their lives would unfold or what their role was in the world, what American culture was, are undermined by a world where we can choose, you know, we can consume culture from all over the world. We can mix with people from all over the world. And we can have our own sort of core beliefs and ways of doing things challenged much more easily than we could in a less media globalized era. And I just think there's no question that any culture has a minority of people in it who react very badly to the challenge of modernity, and that there's going to be a tiny minority of people who react to that violently.
Well, how much, though, is it, for example, the hatred of government or the notion that government is the enemy, which was not first propagated, but certainly in the modern era by Ronald Reagan, and it has become a kind of Republican mantra that government is the problem. And obviously, extremists have taken that on the far right to extraordinary lengths. But what I detect, which I find is a great paradox, is that the far right in this country have this voluntary alienation from a government that they think is evil and in trying to impose and take away their guns. And on the far left, you've got these conspiracy theories about the 9/11 truthers, etc., that ascribe all kinds of extraordinary cleverness and evil intentions to a government that is obviously in many ways incompetent, as it certainly was at 9/11, in not protecting the homeland. And so you have this strange kind of alienation on the far right and the far left in this country. I don't know how big a factor it is, but I find it extraordinary.
You could certainly argue that a common thread uniting many of the of our ancestors who immigrated here, certainly not all, but many, was a healthy suspicion, distaste, or inability to get along with the governments of the society they came from. That certainly happens to be true of my ancestors. So you know, yes, I do think that strand runs very strongly through American culture. I do think, though, it's worth, you know, noticing that one of the things that has puzzled people who were trying to make quick and easy sense of the Boston bombings is that it isn't an attack on a government facility. It is an attack on a government building. You know, it's an attack on something that's a popular symbol of civic pride and of multinational pride. That, you know, to attack the marathon, you had to know that you were going to kill. I mean, you had to know that you were likely to kill and hurt foreigners, not just Americans. So that it is, whatever it is that turns out to be going on here, it's not as simple as someone wanting to attack the government of the United States, either from the left or the right.
But is alienation, I recall there was a book about Bowling Alone written by Harvard Professor Putnam. Is there an unusual amount of sort of voluntary alienation in this country? We've got less than half, quite often half the population even votes, and a number of Americans really, both on the left and the right, feel that the government is alien from them, if not hostile to them. And it seems sort of odd because obviously, you know, you get the government you deserve by the extent to which you participate in it.
It is absolutely clear, by the way, that alienation is one of the biggest predictors for who will turn to violence. And that's true across, you know, whatever kind of terrorism you look at, that it's people who experience being profoundly alienated from their culture. At the same time, it's true that the U.S. has always been a place that both had a vibrant civic culture, just as vibrant a civic culture as any other country, and in some ways vibrant cultures full of people who were really proud of how alienated from their government institutions they were. You know, we have all these myths that we tell ourselves about how marvelously independent we all are, even as, you know, most of our parents and grandparents and great-grandparents grew up in tight-knit communities and depended on community support. So, yeah, that's a myth that we use, and it's a myth that clearly gets warped and distorted by folks who have personal alienation issues.
Well, Heather Hilbert, I thank you so much for joining us here. We could have had a much longer conversation, but hopefully we'll talk again.
Pleasure to be with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Heather Hilbert, who's the Executive Director of the National Security Network, where her policy work focuses primarily on the politics of U.S. foreign policy, counterterrorism and resilience, and the nexus of civilian and military approaches to conflict resolution. She has previously served in the White House, State Department and the Congress, and from 1995 to 2001, she served in the Clinton administration as Special Assistant and Speechwriter to the President, Speechwriter for Secretaries of State Albright and Christopher, and a member of the State Department's Policy Planning Staff. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the failure of the Senate to even consider a watered-down bill on expanding background checks and the President's angry rebuke of the Congress.
Home, home on the range, where the deer and the antelope play, where seldom is heard a discouraging word, and the skies are not cloudy all day.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dennis Hannigan, who is the former president of the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence and founder of the Center's Legal Action Project. He's the author of Lethal Logic, Exploding the Myths That Paralyze American Gun Policy. And also joining us is John Donahue, who is a professor of law at Stanford Law School and research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. He has written numerous publications on gun control policy and is the author of Shooting Down the More Guns, Less Crime Hypothesis. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dennis Hennigan and John Donahue.
Thank you, Ian.
And let me begin with Dennis Hannigan. Since you've worked on the Hill for decades trying to get gun control legislation through. And, of course, today was a dismal day for gun control, although arguably, semantically, it would be better to have called it gun safety or something else, just as the abortion argument of right to life versus pro-choice isn't in many ways an adequate framing of an issue. But that aside, the president obviously was angry, and he called this a shameful day in the nation's capital, that not even a watered-down bill on expanding background checks for weapon sales even got a hearing.
Well, it is a shameful day. It's a very sad day. The president was angry, and quite frankly, the American people deserve to be angry because their clearly expressed will about common sense gun laws was frustrated. It was frustrated by acts of political cowardice on the part of a number of United States senators who responded to very well-developed tactics of fear and intimidation that the NRA uses successfully over and over again. And you just have to wonder, I mean, there's something fundamentally wrong with our democracy if a proposal that is supported by 90% of the American people cannot get through the United States Congress. And I think it is extremely important for supporters of common sense gun legislation to, you know, spend some time grieving over this loss, but then to rally and to realize that a great deal of great mobilization has happened over the last several months after Newtown. There is a great deal to build on, and there is far too much at stake for people to simply lick their wounds and go home and give up this noble fight.
And John Donahue, you're the author of "Shooting Down the More Guns, Less Crime" hypothesis. So much of what the proponents of the although the supporters of the NRA and the NRA itself put forth in their arguments ultimately come down to a kind of bizarre notion that the status quo is acceptable. Apart from the fact that you're able to explode the logic of much of their arguments. Is this clearly not being driven by logic on the anti-gun control side?
No, it's largely being governed by fear. I think Dennis correctly noted the public opinion poll preferences for the overwhelming majority for the passage of these laws. But in those same public opinion polls, there also was expressed concern that the passage of these background checks, universal background checks, might lead to some form of confiscation. And even though that view is completely nonsensical, a very substantial number, it wasn't a majority, but a substantial number of people bought that argument because the NRA, which purports to speak for lawful gun owners, was trumpeting that idea. And when an organization that you believe in tells you something over and over again, you tend to believe it. In this case, it's simply a lie. And I think the president was right to call it a willful lie on the part of the NRA, because there wasn't the slightest possibility of gun confiscation, unless you're talking about preventing a felon or someone who's mentally ill from getting a gun, which is current law.
But John Donahue, the NRA has 4 million members. That's a 1% of the American population. So how does the 1% have trumped the 99%?
You're right. The NRA is a very small organization. For example, the AARP has 40 million Americans. So if the people were to express their preferences with the same intensity as the NRA, you would see some change. But you have to remember, the NRA doesn't get its power from the 4 million. The NRA gets its power from its money and its connection to the gun manufacturing and gun sellers' money and power. And that's a potent force that has to be reckoned with if you want to prevail in Congress. And we saw that many congressmen are both attentive to the benefits that NRA sponsorship can give them, and also fearful that the NRA can marshal not just the 1%, but this much larger number. With something like 48% of Americans thought that these laws might lead to gun confiscation, and that fear was a real one on the part of many gun owners, even though there's absolutely no truth to that position. But as I said, the NRA is very effective in misleading, much the way the tobacco industry for many years misled people on the dangers of smoking.
Well, let me turn then to Dennis Hannigan, who is a former president of the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence and author of Lethal Logic, Exploding the Myths That Paralyze American Gun Policy. The final vote on the watered-down Manchin-Toomey plan was 54-46. So you had the odd symmetry of four Republicans joining with the Democratic majority and four Democrats joining with the Republican minority. Now, on Dianne Feinstein's update of the 1994 ban on assault weapons, the vote was 40-60. So that really went down in flames. So what's your sense then of is this going to change? Are they going to do something about this filibuster, this ridiculous usurpation of power that the Republicans have in the Senate, where you have to have 60 votes to get anything even discussed?
Well, I certainly hope so. It would appear that in a democracy, the majority should prevail. And there may be some safeguards that we want to build into our system to protect the rights of the minority. But this is a situation in which the minority can frustrate every piece of legislation. And we didn't have this situation throughout most of our history. This is a very recent development that you have to have 60 votes in order to get anything passed. So we need to reconsider those rules in the Senate because this is a problem of the majority of the American people having their views constantly frustrated. And the gun issue, I think, is the single most dramatic illustration of the problem. It is almost unheard of for a legislative idea to have the support of 90% of the American people. This idea of expanded background checks had that level of support, and that was not reflected in this vote today. Now, I will say this. There has been progress made politically on this issue. This issue was in the political wilderness several months ago, and that changed dramatically right after the Sandy Hook shooting, where you had the Obama administration that had run from the gun issue throughout its 4 years, embraced the gun issue because it was the right thing to do, and put aside all of the political fears that had paralyzed the Obama administration in doing anything about guns. The fact that you had a Senator Manchin of West Virginia and a Senator Toomey, Republican of Pennsylvania, two pretty conservative senators sitting down and actually crafting a bill to close the gun show loophole, that represents progress. It means that there are senators from high gun-owning states who are willing to let reason prevail and think they can explain to their gun-owning constituents the reason to do these things. And so there is something to build on. What's critical is that the pro-gun control forces must not melt away. The Obama administration must not retreat from the strong stand that it's made. And these politicians who went against their own constituents and in favor of the gun lobby need to pay a price at the polls. That's absolutely critical. There needs to be substantial political money on the gun control side, and I think that's beginning to happen. And there needs to be a building of a new movement for sensible gun laws.
And again, John Donohue, professor of law at Stanford Law School and author of Shooting Down the More Guns, Less Crime Hypothesis. There was from the gallery shouts from a woman whose daughter was shot at Virginia Tech and another woman who was a survivor of the mass shooting at Tucson. They shouted, "Shame on you." They need to be ashamed of themselves before they were escorted out. They shouted, they have no souls. They have no compassion. How about what happened to the emotions that followed the Sandy Hook massacre? Is there a way to harness these things and retain them? Or do we suffer from compassion fatigue? Why is it that people sort of give up so easily when they're so enraged after these hideous events, which, of course, will happen again?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the sad parts of the American political process that the public remains excited about an issue. But as I wrote, like within hours of the killing at Newtown, the American public will lose interest much more quickly than the NRA will lose interest. And so I think Dennis's point is a good one, that when 90+ percent of the American people want something, they have the power to make that happen. But they will only exercise that power and achieve their goal if they show the same intensity that the NRA and the gun manufacturers show in this country. And so far, that hasn't happened. But this may be an opportunity to marshal that political force and show that the NRA does not run policy in the United States, but the American people run policy in the United States.
But already the press is saying that the president lost. I mean, obviously, this was not an issue he wanted, and Dennis said the Democrats have been pretty cowardly on this issue, but it was foisted on them. But the idea that the president had lost, not the American people, I often wonder what planet we're on here.
Well, I will say I think that the president, although he lost this battle, he knows that there is an ongoing war. And it's a political war. I mean, as the president said today, politics triumphed over reason today. So we're going to have to engage on the political battlefield, and the president is very capable of skillfully doing that. And the first opportunity will come in the next midterm elections. I think what he is going to do is he's going to stay in the game. He's going to use this as an organizing tool to change the political dynamic around this issue. And that fundamentally is what needs to happen. And as I said before, I think there was progress made toward a recasting of the political dynamic in this vote today. You had some rock-ribbed NRA supporters. These were senators who we couldn't hope to get on any kind of gun vote in the past, voting for closing the gun show loophole, and indeed helping to craft that bill. So this is progress. Now we need to show that those folks who step forward and were courageous can survive electorally, and the people who voted with the gun lobby and against the American people need to be put at risk politically.
And John Donohue, mm-hmm. How can you marshal reason and make that a stronger weapon than I guess, you know, paranoid fantasies or whatever? How do you describe Senator Grassley and this constant refrain that criminals don't, you know, background checks don't affect criminals, as though not having background checks is somehow better than having them? I mean, where's the logic? And you've written a book, Shooting Down the More Guns, Less Crime Hypothesis. So, you know, you win the arguments, but you lose the war.
Yeah, it is true that the NRA has done a remarkably effective job in scaring people in certain instances and then misleading them in other instances. And it really becomes the responsibility of academics to step up to the plate a little bit more, the media to correctly identify the good studies that are out there and undermine the totally incredible and implausible claims that the NRA frequently spouts, and then for the American people to step up. Because if the American people care about gun violence and want to take reasonable steps to reduce it, as the public opinion polls show, they have the power to make that happen, but they have to remember it come election time. They can't just think about it in the days and weeks following the latest mass killing. You know, in Australia, when they had a horrific mass shooting, within a very short number of weeks, they had imposed the most stringent gun controls and mandatory buybacks. And they went from a situation where they had had 13 mass shootings over a previous 16-year period to none in the successive 16-year period. So things can be done in this domain, but it does take concerted and intentional effort to make politicians stand up on the right side. 90% speaks loudly to politicians if they think people are going to vote on that. If they think the only people who are going to vote on that issue are the people who have been misled by the NRA, then they'll listen to the people who are misled by the NRA.
Well, just in the last minute, Dennis Hannigan, given that the NRA is only 4 million people, they are the 1%, yet they have the ability to thwart the 90% in the United States Senate, and they probably have even more ability in the House of Representatives, given the Republican control. So how do you break that knot? I mean, is Bloomberg financing candidates? Is it a money race? What's the future going to be?
Well, there are many elements to a winning effort on this issue. Certainly, the investment of significant political resources is an absolute necessity. Mayor Bloomberg has begun to expend significant resources in this area. I think that actually Gabby Giffords and Mark Kelly are going to be raising some money. So that's one element. But I also want to go back and really pay tribute to scholars like John Donahue, who have contributed so much to our knowledge of this issue. I think John may have mentioned the comparison to the tobacco issue. I now work in the tobacco control movement, and it's a very apt comparison because part of what changed our nation's approach towards tobacco is the development of solid research showing that tobacco products do, in fact, cause death and disease, that tobacco products are, in fact, addictive. Sure. And overcoming the efforts of the tobacco industry to introduce doubt about those propositions. One of the things we've missed in the gun control world is adequate financing of research. And that's one of the most important initiatives that the president has undertaken here, is that he has basically ordered CDC and other agencies to get back into the business of doing research on the gun issue. And
well, Dennis, I'm afraid
we need that to happen. It's going to be very important, but there are many elements to a winning effort on this.
Well, I thank both of you gentlemen for joining us here today. Dennis Hannigan, former president of the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence and author of Lethal Logic, Exploding the Myths That Paralyze American Gun Policy, and John Donahue, the author of Shooting Down the More Guns, Less Crime Hypothesis. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about the new Pope continuing the war against American nuns.
I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head, even if he had to wrong someone. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head.
Someone, yeah. Gideon, what have you told us at all? Make a sound.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Kenneth Briggs, who writes for the National Catholic Reporter. He's a professor at Lafayette College and a former New York Times religion editor, and is the author of Power of Forgiveness and Double Crossed, Uncovering the Catholic Church's Betrayal of American Nuns. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kenneth Briggs.
Thank you very much.
And I imagine a lot of liberal Catholics in the United States who welcomed this new pope and saw him washing the feet of the poor, etc. Maybe they're having second thoughts now that the Vatican issued a statement on Monday that Pope Francis had reaffirmed the doctrine evaluation and criticism of the U.S. nuns made by his predecessor, Pope Benedict, charging the nuns with promoting radical feminist themes and ignoring the Vatican's hard line on same-sex marriage and abortion.
Yes, after according the new pope, a great deal of goodwill. This is the first real card that he has played, and certainly in terms of a major issue, and a lot of Catholics, I'm sure, are just sorely disappointed. At least the initial reports are that there's a great deal of discouragement And I wouldn't say disillusion yet, because there's still some cushion of celebration and acceptance and likability that hasn't gone away, but a great deal of disappointment that this has gone so apparently negatively toward the original judgment.
And the Leadership Conference of Women Religious represent 57,000 Catholic sisters, which is 80% of all U.S. nuns, and they have met with the new head of the Vatican's doctrinal watchdog group, the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith, from which the previous Pope, Pope Benedict, came. One of the things that I had learned recently, and I'd like to get more information on, Kenneth Briggs, from an interview I did with Matthew Fox, the Catholic theologian who was hounded out of his order by Ratzinger when he was in charge of the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith. And he said that a lot of this is to do with the fact that the German church is extremely conservative but very powerful, because they're the biggest contributors of money to the Vatican. And so now you have this new Archbishop Gerhard Ludwig Müller as the head of the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith, and you have this new Pope, Pope Francis, having gone to Germany quite late in his life to study. Is there a connection there? Are we talking about a kind of clique within the Vatican?
I think it's true to say that that Germany has been a very strong theological center and source of thinking for many, many decades. I wouldn't characterize the general church as being so conservative. I think the mixture is fairly strong between a rather hearty liberalism and a certain degree of conservatism. I think it's more in terms of continuing to reinforce the previous decisions of popes. The number one rule in the papacy would seem, on the basis of history, to be thou shalt never contradict a major policy of a previous pope. And that seems to be taking place right now. However, it's also fair to say that it may be consistent with a fair judgment on the part of the Vatican that the sisters, in fact, are in disagreement with the Vatican over key teachings such as women's ordination and a number of the sexual issues, disagreement does exist, and that judgment may be fair. However, there is accompanying method of operation and style of accusation that raises great objections, primarily around this notion that this represents, the disagreements represent a kind of radical secular feminism to which most nuns, I think, would take great exception. Most American Catholics would take great exception.
So when you say that popes don't contradict doctrines of their predecessors and that they carry on and there's a continuity there, isn't that kind of contradicted, though, by what happened to Vatican II, in particular Pope John Paul? Almost, if he didn't ignore it, he certainly did everything he could to sidetrack it, and it seems to have been stalled ever since.
That's a very good point that points to the special function of a Vatican Council, which don't happen very often. But within the history of the Church, Church councils, which are made up of all the bishops of the world gathered together, has an authority equal to or superior to the Pope itself, to the papacy itself. And Vatican II was summoned by Pope John the 23rd as a way of looking at the Church and deciding policy. In that sense, the Second Vatican Council had a degree of authority that matches a great deal of papal authority, so that it came about that way. And even though it turned the direction of the Church a great deal in terms of policy, attitudes toward all sorts of things, including the whole world, it did so under authority that had come through the Church's own tradition. In that sense, it would not have been the Pope himself contradicting previous popes, but calling for a council that then went ahead and made certain decisions that took off in another direction.
So, obviously, it's early now, early days to assess this new Pope, and his arrival on the scene was greeted as a refreshing change, that he was a humble man who took the bus and cooked for himself, and he's shown some examples of humility. But his past in Argentina has been vigorously denied by the new head of Vatican Radio, who is a Jesuit and has been quite outspoken in terms of that the Pope bears no responsibility or had no collusion with the generals who committed genocide against their own people. Do you think that has been thoroughly answered? Because a lot of people don't.
I think there will be a lingering set of questions around that behavior, namely that even though there may have not been collusion, the questions will center on whether enough was done to resist the dictatorship and the regime that occupied Argentina at the time. And again, to the character of the Pope, he is a very appealing personality. He's won many friends through style. The question is, on matters of substance, would he follow through and give vigorous opposition by taking initiatives that would seem to set the Church in another direction? And in this case, primarily along the lines of how the Church looks at women and their roles, both within society and the Church. And so that's where the questions come. Is he a placeholder who is friendly and appealing and approachable, but one who does not touch matters of substance, or will he have another dimension to him where that carries through in a kind of liberalizing of certain policies? So far, there has not been an indication of that. It's awfully early yet to see. But the style implies a kind of different form of papacy that would have a different approach to issues, that would be, it would seem more liberal. But that's not necessarily the case, because he could easily be one who affirms everything that has come to him in terms of Church policy, while showing a very friendly, appealing face to the world.
Well, you were quoted, Kenneth Briggs, recently in the Los Angeles Times, saying it seems like the Vatican has put a more appealing salesman in charge of the same old product.
That largely seems to be the case right now, that that matters that really rub against so many American Catholics in particular, matters of sexuality, but not exclusively sexuality, and dealing with the place of women within the realm of the church, those issues are yet to be propounded in some direct way. And this is the first sign that there may not be any budging, that they may be the same package that's being offered to the American Catholic public by a different salesman, as it were.
Well, when the previous pope went after the American nuns, there was a real pushback, particularly from James Martin, a Jesuit priest who's editor of Americana magazine, and he was quoted in the Daily Beast at the time saying, "For many Catholics, sisters are the glue that holds the church together." And he is, you know, basically saying, in terms of this new pope, since the new pope's a Jesuit, he's saying, well, you know, maybe we should just wait and see whether there will be at some point later a sympathetic hearing. But do they understand in the Vatican what Father Martin's point is, that the nuns are the glue? And I remember at the time when the healthcare, Obamacare, came down to the wire and there was one key vote and it looked like it may go down, and the nuns intervened on this apparently very devout Catholic Democrat who was key to the vote, and he changed his mind. And he was, of course, being lobbied by the bishops in this country who seemed to be resolutely Republican and incredibly conservative. I mean, that's just a personal opinion, that the nuns seem to be more on the side of the example, if you will, of Jesus Christ.
I think this whole incident and the both ill-timed and ill-conducted attack against the American nuns by the Vatican stirred up something that has a both negative and positive dimension to it. The negative one is that it was an attack such as it was. The positive was it awakened American Catholics to the enormous contribution that nuns had made to the church. The nuns had, in effect, carried the church's tradition from generation to generation by having the most immediate and sustained contact with ordinary Catholics, with anyone in the church. And I think what has happened is that there's been a kind of belated, gigantic thank you to the sisters and a rallying to their side because of the memory of the sisters' contribution to their lives and the lives of previous Catholics. So, yes, the glue part, I think, is quite correct. There's no denying, however, that nuns, many nuns, and not all nuns, of course, have come to see Catholicism in a different way that dissents from Vatican-approved theology and ways of looking at things, and that even as they've been doing heroic service for the church, they have been liable and likely to change their theological outlook and be more attuned to current trends within theology and within their own thinking. As a result, we get sisters who, in effect, are very much attuned to the times, the way the Vatican Council said they were supposed to be, and continuing to do great service. One part accords well with the Vatican, the other part doesn't. So the Vatican is ready to bend over backwards to praise nuns along with the great American uproar in favor of the nuns, saying that they do deserve credit while not liking the thinking that's going on and the dissent that's arisen in that pathway.
But there does appear to be, Kenneth Briggs, a real division and divide here, and it's very apparent at the political level. Sister Simone Campbell, for example, spoke at the Democratic Convention. Most of the Catholic bishops oppose this White House. They've gone on this jihad against the health care bill, suggesting that somehow it's pro-abortion when there's absolutely no substance to that charge. And there is, of course, a longstanding law banning federal funds for abortion. And you've got these incredibly conservative Catholics on the Supreme Court in Scalia, Thomas, and Kennedy. Well, no, Kennedy's a kind of a swing vote, but Scalia, Thomas, Alito, and Roberts. So there seems to be two different worlds here. And is it to do with the fact that the women are second-class citizens? They can't be ordained, that they're the kind of worker bees. They're like the secretaries in Mad Men, you know, whereas the executives are all these people living in this sort of hallowed world of ritual and sanctity.
I think there's a great deal to that. And while I wouldn't say it's entirely male-female polemical, it is to a great extent a sign of the vast difference between the assertion of male leadership authority and perspective that tends has formed the basis of the dogma and doctrine of the church, and a perspective that is rising up and has risen up from women who bring a very different perspective and witness to what Catholicism means in the lives of Catholics, and that whole half or more than half of Catholicism that is shut out of the ordained ministry of the Catholic Church and out of the decision-making of the Catholic Church, including nuns, who, of course, are lay people and are shut out of the decision-making process. They have no role in the Church's official authority lines at all. And so you do get this now bubbling up of an outlook, a point of view that has many elements of women's experiences living the faith in the world that has not been part and parcel of the church's highest realms of leadership, and so that's where a lot of the tension does arise, I believe.
Well, just in closing, Kenneth Briggs, is there early indications are that this new pope may well be the same as the old pope in terms of doctrine. When will we know whether or not the nuns are going to be really censured? They have the bishop in Seattle has been put in charge of this inquiry into the errant nature of American nuns' activity. And you've got the new head of the doctrine, the German Archbishop Gerhard Ludwig Müller, watching over his shoulder. What's your sense of when we'll know one way or the other whether this jihad, if you will, against the nuns is going to continue?
I think it will have somewhat to do with the orders that come down as to how this is supposed to be implemented. I think the indictment of the leadership conference of women religious that they have been in dissent against theology, I think that will remain. And meanwhile, the sisters do not acknowledge that they are in dissent, and that becomes a problem that needs some more clarity. But then the implementation process, which includes a mandate to reform what is what they're accused of being as radical feminists, requires a much tougher sense of discipline and reform. Whether this pope will signal that the discipline and the reform has to go on as it has in order to clear this up, it remains to be seen.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Kenneth Briggs.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Kenneth Briggs, who writes for the National Catholic Reporter. He's a professor at Lafayette College and a former New York Times religion editor, and is the author of Power of Forgiveness and Double Crossed, Uncovering the Catholic Church's Betrayal of American Nuns. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.